could penetrate into his lungs. Both men are so focused on their next hit of cocaine or heroin or jib, crystal meth, that self-preservation pales into insignificance. Many also have an ingrained fear of authority figures and distrust institutions, for reasons no one could begrudge them. "The reason I do drugs is so I don't feel the fucking feelings I feel when I don't do drugs," Nick, a 40-year-old heroin and crystal meth addict, once told me, weeping as he spoke. "When I don't feel the drugs in me, I get depressed." His father drilled into his twin sons the notion that they were nothing but pieces of shit. Nick's brother committed suicide as a teenager. Nick became a lifelong addict. The hell realm of painful emotions frightens most of us. Drug addicts fear they would be trapped there forever, but for their substances. This urge to escape exacts a fearful price. The cement hallways and the elevator at the Portland Hotel are washed clean frequently, sometimes several times a day. Punctured by needle marks, some residents have chronic, draining wounds. Blood also seeps from blows and cuts inflicted by their fellow addicts or from pits patients have scratched in their skin during fits of cocaine-induced paranoia. One man picks at himself incessantly to get rid of imaginary insects. Not that we lack real infestation in the downtown east side. Rodents thrive between hotel walls and in the garbage-strewn back alleys. Vermin populate many of my patients' beds, clothes, and bodies. Bedbugs, lice, scabies. Cockroaches occasionally drop out from shaken skirts and pant legs in my office and scurry for cover under my desk. "I like having one or two mice around," one young man told me. "They eat the cockroaches and bedbugs, but I can't stand a whole nest of them in my mattress." Vermin, boils, blood, and death. The plagues of Egypt. In the downtown east side, the angel of death slays with shocking alacrity. Marcia, a 35-year-old heroin addict, had moved out of her PHS residence and was living in a tenement half a block away. One morning I received a frantic phone call about a suspected overdose. I found Marcia in bed, her eyes wide open, lying on her back and already in rigor mortis. Her arms were extended, palms outward in a gesture of alarmed protest, as if to say, "No, you've come to take me too soon. Much too soon." Plastic syringes cracked under my shoes as I approached her body. Marcia's dilated pupils and some other physical cues told the story. She died not of overdose, but of heroin withdrawal. I stood for a few moments by her bedside, trying to see in her body the charming, if always absent-minded human being I had known. As I turned to leave, wailing sirens signaled the arrival of emergency vehicles outside. Marcia had been in my office just the week before, in good cheer, asking for help with some medical forms she needed to fill out to get back on welfare. It was the first time I'd seen her in 6 months. During that period, as she explained with nonchalant resignation, she had helped her boyfriend Kyle blow through a $130,000 inheritance, a process selflessly aided by many other user friends and hangers-on. For all that popularity, she was alone when death caught her. Another casualty was Frank, a reclusive heroin addict who would grudgingly let you into his cramped quarters at the Regal Hotel only when he was very ill. "No fucking way I'm dying in hospital," he declared, once it became clear that the Grim Reaper AIDS was knocking at his door. There was no arguing with Frank about that or anything else. He died in his own ragged bed, but his bed, in 2002. Frank had a sweet soul that his curmudgeonly abrasiveness could not hide. Although he never talked to me about his life experience, he expressed the gist of it in Downtown Hellbound Train, a poem he wrote a few months before his death. It is a requiem for himself and for the dozens of women, drug users, sex trade workers, said to have been murdered at the infamous Picton Pig Farm outside Vancouver. Went downtown, Hastings and Maine, looking for relief from the pain. All I did was find a one-way ticket on a hell-bound train. On a farm not far away, several friends were taken away. Rest their souls from the pain, end their ride on the hell-bound train. Give me peace before I die. The track is laid out so well. We all live our private hell. Just more tickets on the hell-bound train. Hell-bound train. Hell-bound train. One-way ticket on a hell-bound train. Having worked in palliative medicine, care of the terminally ill, I have encountered death often. In a real sense, addiction medicine with this population is also palliative work. We do not expect to cure anyone, only to ameliorate the effects of drug addiction and its attendant ailments, and to soften the impact of the legal and social torments our culture uses to punish the drug addict. Except for the rare fortunate ones who escape the downtown East Side drug colony, very few of my patients will live to old age. Most will die of some complication of their HIV or hepatitis C or of meningitis or a massive septicemia contracted through multiple self-injections during a prolonged cocaine run. Some will succumb to cancer at a relatively young age, their stressed and debilitated immune systems unable to keep malignancy in check. That's how Stevie died, of liver cancer, the sweet sardonic expression that always played on her face, obscured by deep jaundice. Or they'll do a bad fix one night and die of an overdose, like Angel at the Sunrise Hotel, or like Trevor, one floor above, who always smiled as if nothing ever bothered him. One darkening February evening, Leona, a patient who lives in a nearby hotel, awoke on the cot in her room to find her 18-year-old son, Joey, lifeless and rigid in her bed. She had taken him in from the street and was keeping watch to save him from self-harm. Mid-morning, after an all-night vigil, she fell asleep. He overdosed in the afternoon. "When I woke up," she recalled, "Joey was lying motionless. Nobody had to tell me. The ambulance and fire guys came, but there was nothing anybody could do. My baby was dead." Her grief is oceanic, her sense of guilt fathomless. One constant at the Portland Clinic is pain. Medical school teaches the three signs of inflammation in Latin: calor, rubor, dolor, heat, redness, and pain. The skin, limbs, or organs of my patients are often inflamed, and for that my ministrations can be at least temporarily adequate. But how to soothe souls inflamed by the intense torment imposed first by childhood experiences almost too sordid to believe, and then with mechanical repetition by the sufferers themselves? And how to offer them comfort when their sufferings are made worse every day by social ostracism, by what the scholar and writer Elliot Layton has described as the bland, racist, sexist, and classist prejudices buried in Canadian society, an institutionalized contempt for the poor, for sex trade workers, for drug addicts and alcoholics, for Aboriginal people. The pain here in the downtown East Side reaches out with hands begging for drug money. It stares from eyes cold and hard, or downcast with submission and shame. It speaks in cajoling tones or screams aggressively. Behind every look, every word, each violent act or disenchanted gesture is a history of anguish and degradation, a self-writ tale with new chapters added each day and scarcely a happy end. As Daniel drives me home, we're listening to CBC on the car radio, broadcasting its whimsical afternoon cocktail of lighthearted patter, classics, and jazz. Jolted by the disharmony between the urbane radio space and the troubled world I've just left, I recall my first patient of the day, Madeline sits hunched, elbows resting on her thighs, her gaunt, wiry body convulsed by sobbing. She clutches her head in her hands, periodically clenching her fists and beating rhythmically at her temples. Straight brown hair, fallen forward, veils her eyes and cheeks. Her lower lip is swollen and bruised, and blood trickles from a small cut. Her thick, boyish voice is hoarse with rage and pain. "I've been fucked over again," she cries. "It's always me, the sucker for everyone else's bullshit. How do they know they can do it to me every time?" She coughs as the tears trickle down her windpipe. She's like a child telling her story, asking for sympathy, pleading for help. The tale she tells is a variation on a theme familiar in the downtown East Side, drug addicts exploiting each other. Three women Madeline knows well give her $100 bill. The deal is she buys 12 rocks of crack from the person she calls the spick. She gets one, they'll keep some for themselves, and resell the rest. "We can't let the cops see us buy that much," they tell her. The transaction is completed, money and rocks are exchanged. 10 minutes later, the great big spick catches up with Madeline, grabs me by the hair, throws me on the ground, gives me a punch in the face. The $100 bill is counterfeit. "They set me up. Oh, Maddie, you're my buddy. You're my friend." I had no idea it was a bogus hundred. My clients often speak about the spick, but he's an unseen presence, a mythical figure I only hear about. On the street corners near the Portland Hotel, young, olive-hued Central Americans congregate, black baseball caps over their eyes. As I walk by, they call out to me in a low whisper, even with my signal stethoscope around my neck. "Up, down," or "good rock." Up and down are junkie slang for cocaine, an upper, a stimulant, and for heroin, a downer, a sedative. Rock is crack cocaine. "Hey, can't you see that's the doctor?" someone occasionally hisses. The spick may well be amongst that group, or perhaps the epithet is a generic term that refers to any of them. I don't know who he is or the path that led him to Vancouver's Skid Row, where he pushes cocaine and slaps around the emaciated women who steal, deal, cheat, or sell cheap oral sex to pay him. Where was he born? What war, what deprivation forced his parents out of their slum or their mountain village to seek a life so far north of the equator? Poverty in Honduras? Paramilitaries in Guatemala? Death squads in El Salvador? How did he become the spick, a villain in a story told by the rake-thin, distraught woman in my office who, choking on her tears, explains her bruises and asks that I don't hold it against her that she failed to show for last week's methadone visit? "I haven't had juice for 7 days," Madeline says. Juice is slang for methadone. The methadone powder is dissolved in orange-flavored tang. "And I won't ask anybody for help on the street, because if they help you, you owe them your goddamn life. Even if you pay them back, they still think you owe them. There's Maddie, we can hustle her for it, she'll give it to us. They know I won't fight, because if I ever fight, I'm gonna fucking kill one of these bitches down here. I don't want to spend the rest of my life in jail because of some goddamn cunt I never should have gotten involved with in the first place. That's what's going to happen. I can only take so much." I hand her the methadone prescription and invite her back to talk after she's had her dose at the pharmacy. Although Madeline agrees, I won't see her again today. As always, the need for the next fix beckons. Another visitor that morning was Stan, a 45-year-old native man just out of jail, also here for his methadone script. In his 18 months of incarceration, he has become pudgy, and this has softened the menacing air bestowed by his height, muscular build, glowering dark eyes, Apache hair, and Fu Manchu mustache. Or perhaps he's mellowed since he's been off cocaine all this time. He peers out the window at the sidewalk across the street, where a few of his fellow addicts are involved in a scene outside the Army and Navy store. There is much gesticulation and apparently aimless striding back and forth. Look at them, he says. They're stuck here. You know, Doc, their life stretches from here to maybe Victory Square to the left and Fraser Street to the right. They never get out. I want to move away. Don't want to waste myself down here anymore. Ah, what's the use? Look at me, I don't even have socks. Stan points at his worn-out running shoes and baggy red cotton jogging pants with the elastic bunched a few inches above his ankles. When I get on the bus in this outfit, people just know. They move away from me. Some stare, most don't even look in my direction. You know what that feels like? Like I'm an alien. I don't feel right till I'm back here. No wonder nobody ever leaves. When he returns for a methadone script 10 days later, Stan is still living on the street. It's a March day in Vancouver. Gray, wet, and unseasonably cold. You don't want to know where I slept last night, Doc, he says. For many of Vancouver's chronic hardcore addicts, it's as if an invisible barbed wire barrier surrounds the area extending a few blocks from Main and Hastings in all directions. There is a world beyond, but to them it's largely inaccessible. It fears and rejects them, and they, in turn, do not understand its rules and cannot survive in it. I am reminded of an escapee from a Soviet gulag camp who, after starving on the outside, voluntarily turned himself back in. Freedom isn't for us, he told his fellow prisoners. We're chained to this place for the rest of our lives, even though we aren't wearing chains. We can escape, we can wander about, but in the end, we'll come back. People like Stan are among the sickest, the neediest, and the most neglected of any population anywhere. All their lives they've been ignored, abandoned, and in turn self-abandoned time and again. Where does a commitment to serve such a community originate? In my case, I know it is rooted in my beginnings as a Jewish infant in Nazi-occupied Budapest in 1944. I've grown up with the awareness of how terrible and difficult life can be for some people, through no fault of their own. But if the empathy I feel for my patients can be traced to my childhood, so can the reactively intense scorn, disdain, and judgment that sometimes erupt from me, often towards these same pain-driven individuals. Later on, I'll discuss how my own addictive tendencies stem from my early childhood experiences. At heart, I am not that different from my patients. And sometimes I cannot stand seeing how little psychological space, how little heaven-granted grace separates me from them. My first full-time medical position was at a clinic in the downtown East Side. It was a brief 6-month stint, but it left its mark, and I knew that someday I'd come back. When, 20 years later, I was presented with the opportunity to become the clinic physician at the Old Portland, I seized it because it felt right. Just the combination of challenge and meaning I was seeking at that time in my life. With hardly a moment's thought, I left my family practice for a cockroach-infested downtown hotel. What draws me here? All of us who are called to this work are responding to an inner pull that resonates with the same frequencies that vibrate in the lives of the haunted, drained, dysfunctional human beings in our care. But of course we return daily to our homes, outside interests, and relationships, while our addict clients are trapped in their downtown gulag. Some people are attractive to painful places because they hope to resolve their own pain there. Others offer themselves because their compassionate hearts know that here is where love is most needed. Yet others come out of professional interest. This work is ever challenging. Those with low self-esteem may be attracted because it feeds their egos to work with such powerless individuals. Some are lured by the magnetic force of addictions because they haven't resolved or even recognized their own addictive tendencies. My guess is that most of us physicians, nurses, and other professional helpers who work in the downtown East Side are impelled by some mixture of these motives. Liz Evans began working in the area at the age of 26. I was overwhelmed, she recalls. As a nurse, I thought I had some expertise to share. While that was true, I soon discovered that, in fact, I had very little to give. I could not rescue people from their pain and sadness. All I could offer was to walk beside them as a fellow human being, a kindred spirit. A woman I'll call Julie was locked in her room and force-fed a liquid diet and beaten by her foster family from age 7 on. She has a scar across her neck from where she slashed herself when she was only 16. She's used a cocktail of painkillers, alcohol, cocaine, and heroin ever since and works the streets. One night she came home after she'd been raped and crawled into my lap, sobbing. She told me repeatedly that it was her fault, that she was a bad person and deserved nothing. She could barely breathe. I longed to give her anything that would ease her pain as I sat and rocked her. It was too intense for me to bear. As Liz discovered, something in Julie's pain triggered her own. This experience showed me that we have to keep our own issues from turning into barriers. What keeps me here? Muses Kirsten Sursbecker. In the beginning, I wanted to help. And now, I still want to help, but it's changed. Now I know my limits. I know what I can and cannot do. What I can do is to be here and advocate for people at various stages in their lives, and to allow them to be who they are. We have an obligation as a society to support people for who they are, and to give them respect. That's what keeps me here. There's another factor in the equation. Many people who've worked in the downtown East Side have noticed it. A sense of authenticity, a loss of the usual social games, the surrender of pretense, the reality of people who cannot declare themselves to be anything other than what they are. Yes, they lie, cheat, and manipulate, but don't we all in our own way? Unlike the rest of us, they can't pretend not to be cheaters and manipulators. They're straight up about their refusal to take responsibility, their rejection of social expectation, their acceptance of having lost everything for the sake of their addiction. That isn't much by the straight world standards, but there's a paradoxical core of honesty wrapped in the compulsive deceit any addiction imposes. What do you expect, Doc? After all, I'm an addict, a small, skinny, 47-year-old man once said to me with a wry and disarming smile, having failed to wheedle a morphine prescription. Perhaps there's a fascination in that element of outrageous, unapologetic pseudo-authenticity. In our secret fantasies, who among us wouldn't like to be as carelessly brazen about our own flaws? Down here, you have honest interactions with people, says Kim Markell, the nurse at the Portland Clinic. I can come here and actually be who I am. I find that rewarding. Working in the hospitals or in different community settings, there's always pressure to toe the line. Because our work here is so diverse, and because we're among people whose needs are so raw and who have nothing left to hide, it helps me maintain honesty in what I do. There's not that big shift between who I am at work and who I am outside of work. Amidst the unrest of irritable drug seekers hustling and scamming for the next high, there also occur frequent moments of humanity and mutual support. There are amazing displays of warmth all the time, Kim says. Although there's a lot of violence, I see many people caring for each other, adds Bethany Giel, a nurse at Insight, North America's first supervised injection site, located on Hastings, 2 blocks from the Portland. They share food, clothing, and makeup, anything they have. People tend to each other through illness, report with concern and compassion on a friend's condition, and often display more kindness to someone else than they usually give themselves. Where I live, Kirsten says, I don't know the person 2 houses down from me. I vaguely know what they look like, but I certainly don't know their name. Not down here. Here, people know each other. And that has its pros and its cons. It means that people rail at each other and rage at each other, and it also means that people will share their last 5 pennies with each other. People here are very raw, so what comes out is the violence and ugliness that often gets highlighted in the media. But that rawness also brings out raw feelings of joy and tears of joy. Looking at a flower I hadn't noticed, but someone living in a one room at the Washington Hotel has noticed because he's down here every day. This is his world and he pays attention to different details than I do. Nor is humor absent. As I walk my Hastings rounds from one hotel to another, I witness much backslapping banter and raucous laughter.
"Doctor, doctor, give me the news," comes a jazzy sing-song from under the archway of the Washington. "Hey, you need a shot of rhythm and blues," I chant back over my shoulder.
No need to look around, my partner in this well-rehearsed musical routine is Wayne, a sunburned man with long, dirty blonde curls and Schwarzenegger arms tattooed from wrist to biceps. I wait to cross an intersection with Laura, a native woman in her 40s, whose daunting life history, drug dependence, alcoholism, and HIV have not extinguished her impish wit. As the red hand on the pedestrian traffic light yields to the little walking figure, Laura chimes up, her tone a shade sardonic, "White man says go." Our paths coincide for the next half block, and all the while, Laura chuckles loudly at her joke. So do I. The witticisms are often fearlessly self-mocking.
"Used to bench press 200 pounds, Doc,"
Tony, emaciated, shriveled, and dying of AIDS, cracked during one of his last office visits.
"Now, can't even bench press my own dick."
When my addict patients look at me, they are seeking the real me. Like children, they are unimpressed with titles, achievements, worldly credentials. Their concerns are too immediate, too urgent. If they come to like me or to appreciate my work with them, they will spontaneously express pride in having a doctor who is occasionally interviewed on television and is an author. But only then. What they care about is my presence or absence as a human being. They gauge with unerring eye whether I am grounded enough on any given day to coexist with them, to listen to them as persons with feelings, hopes, and aspirations as valid as mine. They can tell instantly whether I'm genuinely committed to their well-being or just trying to get them out of my way. Chronically unable to offer such caring to themselves, they are all the more sensitive to its presence or absence in those charged with caring for them. It is invigorating to operate in an atmosphere so far removed from the regular workaday world, an atmosphere that insists on authenticity. Whether we know it or not, most of us crave authenticity, the reality beyond roles, labels, and carefully honed personae. With all its festering problems, dysfunctions, diseases, and crime, the downtown East Side offers the fresh air of truth, even if it's the stripped, frayed truth of desperation. It holds up a mirror in which we all, as individual human beings and collectively as a society, may recognize ourselves. The fear, pain, and longing we see are our own fear, pain, and longing. Ours, too, are the beauty and compassion we witness here, the courage and the sheer determination to surmount suffering. Chapter 2. The Lethal Hold of Drugs. Nothing records the effects of a sad life so graphically as the human body. Naguib Mahfouz, Palace of Desire. From behind his lectern at an East Hastings funeral chapel, the elderly priest proclaims the world's farewell to Sharon. "How exuberant and joyful she was. 'Here I am, Shanana,' she announced as she burst into a room. On seeing her, who could not feel glad to be alive?" Behind the family, the mourners are dispersed through the sparsely filled chapel. A group of Portland staffers are present, along with 5 or 6 residents and a few people I don't recognize. The young Sharon, I've been told, was model beautiful. Hints of that beauty still remained when I met her 6 years ago, traces gradually erased by her increasingly pallid complexion, sunken cheeks, and decaying teeth. In her last years, Sharon was often in pain. 2 large patches on her left shin were denuded of skin by injection-induced bacterial infections. Reinfection caused repeated skin grafts to slough off, leaving the flesh continually exposed. The exasperated plastic surgeons at St. Paul's Hospital
considered further intervention futile. In her chronically swollen left knee, a bone abscess lurked, flaring up every so often and then subsiding. That osteomyelitis was never fully treated because Sharon couldn't endure the 6 to 8 weeks of hospitalization required to complete the intravenous antibiotic regimen, not even when it appeared that amputation might be the only alternative. Unable to weight bear owing to her inflamed knee joint, Sharon became hostage to a wheelchair in her early 30s. She'd propel it along the Hastings sidewalk at astonishing speed, employing her strong arms and her right leg to boost herself along. The priest tactfully avoids evoking the pain-haunted Sharon, whose drug obsession drove her back to the downtown East Side, but honors her vital essence. "Forgive us, Lord, for we do not know how to cherish. Life is eternal, love is immortal. For every joy that passes, something beautiful is created," intones the priest. At first, all I hear is a litany of funerary cliches, and I am annoyed. Soon, however, I find myself comforted. In the face of untimely death, it occurs to me, there are no cliches. "For always, Sharon, that voice, that spirit, for the peace of eternity, immortal peace." The quiet sobbing of women vibrates in counterpoint to the priest's consoling words. Closing the book on the lectern, he looks solemnly around the room. As he steps off the podium, music is piped in, Andrea Bocelli crooning a sentimental Italian aria. Mourners are invited to pay their last respects to Sharon, who rests in an open coffin below the stage. One by one, they walk up, bow their heads, and step back to honor the family. Beverly, cocaine-induced pick marks disfiguring her face, approaches the coffin. She supports Penny, who is bent over her walker. The two were close friends of Sharon. Tom, whose hoarse, alcohol-fueled evening bellowing resounds up and down Hastings, is dressed in his finest. Stone sober and somber in white shirt and tie, he bows in prayerful silence over the flower-decorated bier and crosses himself. Sharon's white-powdered face wears a naive, uncertain expression, rouged lips closed and slightly awry. It occurs to me that this faintly befuddled, childlike look probably reflects the inner world of the live Sharon more accurately than the raucous character she often presented in my office. Sharon's body was found in her bed one April morning. She lay there on her side as if in dreamy repose, her features undistorted by pain or distress. We could only guess at the cause of death, but overdose was the best surmise. Despite her long-standing HIV infection and her low immune counts, she had not been ill. But we knew she was heavily into heroin use since she'd left the recovery home. There was no drug paraphernalia in her room. It seems she'd injected whatever killed her in a neighbor's apartment before returning to her own. The failed attempt at rehabilitation saddened everyone who cared for her. By all accounts, she'd appeared to be doing well. "Another 4 weeks without injection, Mate," she'd proudly report during her monthly telephone calls. "Send in my methadone script, would you? I don't want to come there to pick it up. I'll just be pulled into using again." Staff visiting the recovery shelter reported that she was vibrant, in good color, cheerful, and optimistic. Despite her heroin relapse, her death was a shock, and even now, with her body laid out in the chapel, hard to accept. Her vivacity, cheer, and irrepressible energy had been so much a part of our lives. After the priest's kind and celebratory words, Sharon should have stood up and walked out with the rest of us. Service over, the mourners mingle in the parking lot for a while before going their separate ways. It's a bright, dazzling day. The first time this year the spring sun has shown its face in the Vancouver sky. I say hello to Gail, a native woman who's bravely approaching the end of her third month without cocaine. 87 days, she beams at me. I can't believe it. It's no mere exercise in willpower. Gail was hospitalized for a fulminant abdominal infection 2 years ago and had a colostomy to rest her inflamed intestines. The severed segments of bowel should have been surgically rejoined long before now, but the procedure was always canceled because Gail's intravenous cocaine use jeopardized the chances of healing. The original surgeon has declined to see her again. "I booked the OR for nothing at least 3 times," he told me. "I won't take another chance." I couldn't argue with his logic. A new specialist has reluctantly agreed to proceed with the operation, but only under the strictest understanding that Gail will stay off the cocaine. Failing this last opportunity, she may, for the rest of her life, discharge her feces into the plastic receptacle taped to her belly. She hates having to change the bag, sometimes several times a day.
"How you doing, Doc?" says the ever-affable Tom, lightly kneading my shoulder. "Good to see you. You're a good man."
"Thanks," I say. "So are you." Still supported by her hefty friend Beverly, skinny little Penny shuffles up. She leans on her walker with her right hand, shading her eyes against the noonday sun with the left. Penny has only recently finished a 6-month course of IV antibiotics for a spinal infection that has left her hunchbacked and weak-legged. "I never expected to see Sharon die before me," she says. "I really thought in hospital last summer I was a goner."
"You were close enough to scare even me," I reply. We both laugh.
I look at this small cluster of human beings gathered at the funeral of a comrade who met her death in her mid-30s. How powerful the addiction, I think, that not all the physical disease and pain and psychological torment can shake loose its lethal hold on their souls.
"In the Nazi Arbeit camps back in 44, when a man was caught smoking one cigarette, the whole barracks would die," a patient, Ralph, once told me. "For one cigarette. Yet even so, the men did not give up their inspiration, their will to live, and to enjoy what they got out of life from certain substances like liquor or tobacco or whatever the case may be."
I don't know how accurate his account was as history, but as a chronicler of his own drug urges and those of his fellow Hastings Street addicts, Ralph spoke the bare truth. People jeopardize their lives for the sake of making the moment livable. Nothing sways them from the habit. Not illness, not the sacrifice of love and relationship, not the loss of all earthly goods, not the crushing of their dignity, not the fear of dying. The drive is that relentless. How to understand the death grip of drug addiction? What keeps Penny injecting after the spinal suppuration that nearly made her paraplegic? Why can't Beverly give up shooting cocaine despite the HIV, the recurring abscesses I've had to drain on her body, and the joint infections that repeatedly put her in hospital? What could have drawn Sharon back to the downtown East Side and her suicidal habit after her 6-month getaway? How did she shrug off the deterrence of HIV and hepatitis, a crippling bone infection, and the chronic burning, piercing pain of exposed nerve endings? What a wonderful world it would be if the simplistic view were accurate, that human beings need only negative consequences to teach them hard lessons. Then any number of fast food franchises would be tickets to bankruptcy. The TV room would be a deserted spot in our homes, and the Portland Hotel could reinvent itself as something more lucrative, perhaps a luxury housing unit with Mediterranean pretensions for downtown yuppies, similar to the sold-out Firenze and España condo developments still under construction around the corner. On the physiological level, drug addiction is a matter of brain chemistry gone askew under the influence of a substance, and as we will see, even before the use of mind-altering substances begins. But we cannot reduce human beings to their neurochemistry. And even if we could, people's brain physiology doesn't develop separately from their life events and their emotions. The addicts sense this. Easy as it would be to pin responsibility for their self-destructive habits on a chemical phenomenon, few of them do so. Few of them accept a narrow medical model of addiction as illness, for all the genuine value of that model. what is the truly fatal attraction of the drug experience? That's a question I've put to many of my clients at the Portland Clinic. "You've got this miserable, swollen, ulcerated leg and foot, red, hot, and painful," I say to Hal, a friendly, jocular man in his 40s, one of my few male patients without a criminal record. "You have to drag yourself to the emergency every day for IV antibiotics. You have HIV. And you won't give up injecting speed. What do you suppose is behind that for you?"
"I don't know," Hal mutters, his toothless gums smothering his words. "You ask anybody, including myself, why should you put something into your body that in the next 5 minutes makes you drool, look gooey, you know, distort your brainwave patterns to the point where you can't think reasonably, inhibits your speech pattern, and then want to do it again?"
"And gives you an abscessed leg," I add helpfully.
"Yes, an abscessed leg. Why? I really don't know."
In March 2005, I had a similar discussion with Alan. Also in his 40s, also with HIV, Alan had been to Vancouver Hospital with sharp chest pains a few days earlier. He was told he'd probably suffered a flare-up of endocarditis, an infection of the heart valves. Declining to be admitted to hospital, Alan presented himself instead for a second opinion at the emergency ward of St. Paul's, where he was assured that everything was fine. Now he was in my office for a third assessment. On examination, I can see he isn't acutely ill, but is nevertheless in terrible shape.
"What should I do, Doc?" he asks, raising his shoulders and spreading his arms out in helpless consternation.
"Okay," I say, reviewing his chart. "Your father died of heart disease. Your brother died of heart disease. You're a heavy smoker. You have a history of endocarditis from IV drug use. I'm treating you for cardiac failure, and even now your legs are swollen because your heart isn't pumping efficiently. Your HIV is controlled by strong medications, and with your hep C, your liver is just hanging in there. But you still keep injecting. And you're asking me what you should do. What's wrong with this picture?"
"I was hoping you'd say that," Alan replies. "You need to tell me I'm a fucking retard. It's the only way I learn."
"Okay, I oblige. You're a fucking retard."
"Thanks, Doc."
"The trouble is you're not a fucking retard. You're addicted. And how are we to understand that?" Alan died 4 months later, cold and blue at midnight on the floor of his room in a nearby hotel. He was injecting, rumor had it, from a bad lot of methadone heisted in a break-in at a local pharmacy and subsequently adulterated with crystal meth or who knows what. According to the coroner's office, that little enterprise in independent drug marketing caused the death of at least 8 people.
"I'm not afraid of dying," a client told me. "Sometimes I'm more afraid of living."
That fear of life, as they have experienced it, underlies my patients' continued drug use.
"Nothing bothers me when I'm high. There's no stress in my life," one person said, a sentiment echoed by many addicted people.
"Makes me just forget," said Dora, an inveterate cocaine user. "I forget about my problems. Nothing ever seems quite as bad as it really is, until you wake up the next morning, and then it's worse." In the summer of 2006, Dora left the Portland and moved back to the streets, hustling for dope. In January, she died of multiple brain abscesses in the intensive care unit of St. Paul's Hospital. Infections fester from bacteria injected into the tissues during drug injection and are carried by blood circulation to internal organs like the lungs, liver, heart, spine, and brain. Alvin is in his 50s, a portly, thick-armed, former long-distance trucker. On methadone to control his heroin addiction, he has recently been increasing his crystal meth use.
"First part of the day, it makes me feel like I want to puke," he says. "But then, after 8 or 9 hoots on the pipe, how does it make me feel? Like a fool, first of all, but I don't know, it's a ritual, I guess."
"Here's what I'm hearing," I counter. "For the privilege of being nauseated and feeling like a fool, you spend $1,000 a month. Is this what you're telling me?"
Alvin laughs. "I only puke on the first one of the day, though.
I get a high of some sort, which lasts about 3 to 5 minutes, and then you say to yourself, why did I do that? But then it's too late. Something makes you keep doing it, and that's what's called addiction. And I don't know how to curb that. Honest to God, I hate this shit. I honestly hate that shit. But you still get something out of it. Well, yeah, or I wouldn't be doing it, obviously. Sort of like having an orgasm, I guess. Beyond the addict's immediate orgasmic release of the moment, drugs have the power to make the painful tolerable and the humdrum worth living for. There is a memory so fixed and so perfect that on certain days my brain listens to no other, writes Stephen Reed, author, incarcerated bank robber, and self-described junkie, of his first hit of narcotics at age 11. I am in profound awe of the ordinary. The pale sky, the blue spruce tree, the rusty barbed wire fence, those dying yellow leaves. I am high. I am 11 years old and in communion with this world. Wholly innocent, I enter into the heart of unknowing. In a similar vein, Leonard Cohen has written about the promise, the beauty, the salvation of cigarettes. Like patterns in a tapestry, recurring themes emerge in my interviews with addicts. The drug as emotional anesthetic, as an antidote to a frightful feeling of emptiness, as a tonic against fatigue, boredom, alienation, and a sense of personal inadequacy, as stress reliever and social lubricant. And, as in Stephen Reed's description, the drug may, if only for a brief instant, open the portals of spiritual transcendence. In places high and low, these themes blight the lives of hungry ghosts everywhere. They act with lethal force on the cocaine, heroin, and crystal meth-wired addicts of the downtown East Side. We will return to them in the next chapter. In a photo we have at the Portland, Sharon, in a black bathing suit, sits on a sun-dappled deck, her legs immersed in the shimmering, clear water of a blue-tiled pool. Relaxed and composed, she smiles directly at the photographer's lens. This is the young woman of joy and possibility memorialized by the priest, captured here by the camera a few months before her death, reveling in the warmth of a late fall afternoon at the home of her 12-step sponsor. In the 12 years Sharon spent in the downtown East Side, she could not complete those 12 steps. She'd been so dysfunctional and cocaine aggressive that until the day she was accepted as a resident at the Portland, she'd been barred from even visiting the hotel. That's how it works, Portland Society Director Kirsten Sturzbecker told me in the foyer of the chapel after Sharon's funeral. There are only two choices. Either you're too much trouble to be allowed to live here, or you're so much trouble that you can live only here. And die only here, Kirsten added, as we stepped out into the sunlight. Chapter 3. The Keys of Paradise. Addiction as a Flight from Distress. Dismissing addictions as bad habits or self-destructive behavior comfortably hides their functionality in the life of the addict. Vincent Felitti, M.D., physician and researcher. It is impossible to understand addiction without asking what relief the addict finds, or hopes to find, in the drug or the addictive behavior. The early 19th century literary figure Thomas De Quincey was an opium user. "The subtle powers lodged in this mighty drug," he rhapsodized, "tranquilize all irritations of the nervous system, sustain through 24 hours the else-drooping animal energies. Oh, just, subtle, and all-conquering opium, thou only givest these gifts to man, and thou hast the keys of paradise." De Quincey's words encapsulate the blessings of all drugs as the addict experiences them. Indeed, as we shall see later, the appeal of all addictive obsessions, with or without drugs. Far more than a quest for pleasure, chronic substance use is the addict's attempt to escape distress. From a medical point of view, addicts are self-medicating conditions like depression, anxiety,
post-traumatic stress, or even ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Addictions always originate in pain, whether felt openly or hidden in the unconscious. They are emotional anesthetics. Heroin and cocaine, both powerful physical painkillers, also ease psychological discomfort. Infant animals separated from their mothers can be soothed readily by low doses of narcotics, just as if it was actual physical pain they were enduring. In popular usage, narcotic may refer loosely to any illicit drug. In this book, as in medical language, narcotics is a term only for opioid drugs either derived from the Asian poppy, like heroin and morphine, or synthetic, like oxycodone. The pain pathways in humans are no different. The very same brain centers that interpret and feel physical pain also become activated during the experience of emotional rejection. On brain scans, they light up in response to social ostracism, just as they would when triggered by physically harmful stimuli. When people speak of feeling hurt or of having emotional pain, they are not being abstract or poetic, but scientifically quite precise. The hard drug addict's life has been marked by a surfeit of pain. No wonder she desperately craves relief. In moments I go from complete misery and vulnerability to total invulnerability, says Judy, a 36-year-old heroin and cocaine addict who is now trying to kick her two-decade habit. I have a lot of issues. A lot of the reason why I use is to get rid of those thoughts and emotions and cover them up. The question is never why the addiction, but why the pain. The research literature is unequivocal. Most hardcore substance abusers come from abusive homes. The majority of my Skid Row patients suffered severe neglect and maltreatment early in life. Almost all the addicted women inhabiting the downtown East Side were sexually assaulted in childhood, as were many of the men. The autobiographical accounts and case files of Portland residents tell stories of pain upon pain, rape, beatings, humiliation, rejection, abandonment, relentless character assassination. As children, they were obliged to witness the violent relationships, self-harming life patterns, or suicidal addictions of their parents, and often had to take care of them. Or they had to look after younger siblings and defend them from being abused, even as they themselves endured the daily violation of their own bodies and souls. One man grew up in a hotel room where his prostitute mother hosted a nightly procession of men as her child slept, or tried to, on his cot on the floor. Carl, a 36-year-old native man, was banished from one foster home after another, had dishwashing liquid poured down his throat at age 5 for using foul language, and was tied to a chair in a dark room in attempts to control his hyperactivity. When he's angry at himself, as he was one day for having used cocaine, he gouges his foot with a knife as punishment. He confessed his sin to me with the look of a terrorized urchin who'd just smashed some family heirloom and dreaded the harshest retribution. Another man described the way his mother used a mechanical babysitter when he was 3 years old. She went to the bar to drink and pick up men. Her idea of keeping me safe and from getting into trouble was to stick me in the dryer. She put a heavy box on top so I couldn't get out. The air vent ensured that the little boy wouldn't suffocate. My prose is unequal to the task of depicting such nearly inconceivable trauma. Our difficulty or inability to perceive the experience of others is all the more pronounced the more distant these experiences are from ours in time, space, or quality, wrote the Auschwitz survivor Primo Levi. We can be moved by the tragedy of mass starvation on a far continent. After all, we have all known physical hunger, if only temporarily. But it takes a greater effort of emotional imagination to empathize with the addict. We readily feel for a suffering child, but cannot see the child in the adult who, his soul fragmented and isolated,
hustles for a survival a few blocks away from where we shop or work.
Levy quotes Jean Améry, a Jewish Austrian philosopher and resistance fighter who fell into the grasp of the Gestapo.
Anyone who was tortured remains tortured. Anyone who has suffered torture never again will be able to be at ease in the world. Faith in humanity, already cracked by the first slap in the face, then demolished by torture, is never acquired again.
Améry was a full-grown adult when he was traumatized, an accomplished intellectual captured by the foe in the course of a war for liberation. We may then imagine the shock, loss of faith, and unfathomable despair of the child who is traumatized not by hated enemies, but by loved ones. Not all addictions are rooted in abuse or trauma, but I do believe they can all be traced to painful experience. A hurt is at the center of all addictive behaviors. It is present in the gambler, the internet addict, the compulsive shopper, and the workaholic. The wound may not be as deep and the ache not as excruciating, and it may even be entirely hidden, but it's there. As we'll see, the effects of early stress or adverse experiences directly shape both the psychology and the neurobiology of addiction in the brain. I asked 57-year-old Richard, an addict since his teens, why he kept using.
"I don't know, I'm just trying to fill a void," he replied.
"Emptiness in my life, boredom, lack of direction." I knew all too well what he meant. "Here I am in my late 50s," he said. "I have no wife, no children. I appear to be a failure. Society says you should be married and have children, a job, that kind of stuff. This way, with the cocaine, I can sit there and do some little thing like rewire the toaster that wasn't working, and not feel like I've lost out on life."
He died a few months after our interview, succumbing to a combination of lung disease, kidney cancer, and overdose.
"I didn't use for 6 years," says Kathy, 42-year-old heroin and cocaine user, back in a grubby downtown East Side hotel after a long absence. She's contracted HIV since her return. "The whole 6 years I craved, it was the lifestyle. I thought I was missing something. And now I look around myself and I think, what the hell was I missing?" Kathy reveals that when she wasn't using, she missed not only the effect of the drugs, but also the excitement of drug seeking and the rituals the drug habit entails.
"I just didn't know what to do with myself. It felt empty."
A sense of deficient emptiness pervades our entire culture. The drug addict is more painfully conscious of this void than most people, and has limited means of escaping it. The rest of us find other ways of suppressing our fear of emptiness or of distracting ourselves from it. When we have nothing to occupy our minds, bad memories, troubling anxieties, unease, or the nagging mental stupor we call boredom can arise. At all costs, drug addicts want to escape spending alone time with their minds. To a lesser degree, behavioral addictions are also responses to this terror of the void.
"Opium," wrote Thomas De Quincey, "is a powerful counteragent to the formidable curse of tedium vitae, the tedium of life." Human beings want not only to survive, but also to live. We long to experience life in all its vividness, with full, untrammeled emotion. Adults envy the open-hearted and open-minded explorations of children. Seeing their joy and curiosity, we pine for our own lost capacity for wide-eyed wonder. Boredom, rooted in a fundamental discomfort with the self, is one of the least tolerable mental states. For the addict, the drug provides a route to feeling alive again, if only temporarily.
"I am in profound awe of the ordinary," recalls author and bank robber Stephen Reed of his first hit of morphine.
Thomas De Quincey extols opium's power to stimulate the capacities of enjoyment. Carol is a 23-year-old resident of the Portland Hotel Society's Stanley Hotel. Her nose and lips are pierced with rings. Around her neck
She wears a chain with a black metal cross. Her hairdo is a pink-dyed mohawk that tapers to blonde locks, cascading.